In Buckner's Ladies' Emporium, Mrs. Guthrie was standing in front of a mirror looking at herself. She was wearing a gown that Nellie Buckner had recommended to her.
What do you think?
Let me have you consult with Miss Wellington. She has recently come into my employ and has a wonderful eye for fashion.
It can't just be pretty, you understand. It must be up to date with the latest fashions from the East.
Miss Wellington has recently arrived from New York. I think you will find her suggestions most helpful. Janelle, won't you come speak with Mrs. Guthrie?
Yes, of course.
Oh, that's a lovely gown.
Yes, but is it fashionable?
She's going to a wedding in Philadelphia. She must be very up to date.
I see. In that case, Mrs. Guthrie, is it?
Yes.
Perhaps you wouldn't mind a couple suggestions?
Oh, I wouldn't mind at all.
Then I would say extend the bustle even farther in the back.
Really? It seems quite large enough to me.
Oh, but they are even larger now. Then we'll add several layers of brightly colored material in beautiful colors. Magenta, gold, brilliant green, and red, all in a waterfall effect.
As she spoke, Janelle grabbed up bolts of cloth and skillfully draped them to give the illusion she was describing. Mrs. Guthrie looked at the effect in the mirror.
Oh, yes. Yes, that would be beautiful, wouldn't it? And this is what they are wearing in New York.
Not everyone in New York. Only the most fashionable ladies are wearing it. During the season, there are a bevy of balls, dinners, parties, receptions, and other activities, many of them hosted by Mrs. Astor or Mrs. Gould. Only the most elite members of the 400 attend such events, and they are always wearing the latest and most fashionable designs. With a few slight alterations to this gown, why, you would fit right in with the 400.
Oh, well, what is the 400?
The 400 are the cream of New York society. I have heard that the number was selected because that was how many people could fit into Mrs. Astor's ballroom.
Oh, my! Someone has a ballroom large enough to hold 400 people!
Mrs. Astor does.
Have you ever seen anyone who belongs to this 400 you are talking about?
In fact, Janelle and her family were members of the 400, but she didn't think it was proper to make that claim.
I have seen them.
Well, surely I must wear this gown to my niece's wedding. Nellie, how soon can you have the gown ready?
When are you leaving for Philadelphia?
Monday morning.
Heavens, this is Friday. That doesn't give us much time. Oh, and Monday is the 4th of July. Do you mean to tell me you're going to miss all the festivities?
I'm afraid so, but I will gladly pay extra to have the gown done in time.
Do you think we could have it finished tomorrow, Janelle?
Oh, yes. We can have it ready for you by tomorrow.
Nellie, wherever did you find this lady? What a wonderful addition she is to your emporium. You must never let her go.
I found her as soon as she came to Phoenix. She will be a valued employee of the Emporium for as long as she wishes.
I cannot wait till I wear it. Oh, the people in Philadelphia will be absolutely pea-green with envy.
Shortly after Mrs. Guthrie left, Ken Buckner came in, wearing a big old smile.
I just entered fixation in the horse race for the 4th of July.
Oh, Ken, after that spill last year, I thought you weren't going to do that anymore.
Don't worry, I learned my lesson. I won't be riding Vexation. I will have someone else ride for me.
Who?
I don't know yet, but I'm sure I can find someone before Monday.
I can ride for you.
Janelle was gathering up the material she was going to add to Mrs. Guthrie's dress.
Beg your pardon? Did you say you would ride Vexation?
Yes. Well, I'm quite a good rider, if I say so myself.
Forgive me for laughing, my dear, but I'm talking about a horse race, not a ride through the park. I don't think you could race sitting side saddle.
Oh, I wouldn't be riding side saddle. I'll ride astride. Where is Vexation? Shall I give you a demonstration?
Women can't ride astride.
Oh, if you're worried about the propriety of such a thing, don't. I have a special riding skirt that will allow me to do so, while still preserving modesty.
It isn't a matter of modesty. Women can't ride astride because their thighs are too rounded.
Excuse me for laughing, but I have never heard such a thing.
Well, everyone knows that.
Then everyone knows something that just isn't true. And I can prove it to you if you let me.
Something that Janelle had shared with nobody since her arrival in Phoenix was the fact that she was an expert horsewoman. Her father kept a stable of horses that were specifically bred for fox hunting. And very quickly, Janelle became the most adept rider, male or female, in the Long Island Hunt Club.
You're serious about this?
Oh, I'm very serious. Where is Vexation now?
I bought him down at Housewright's livery.
I brought my riding habit with me. If you want a riding demonstration, I'll just hurry back to my room and change.
All right. If you are dead set on demonstrating this to me, I'll go down to the livery and get Vexation saddled.
I'll meet you there.
Listen to the two of you. Have you both gone daft? There's no way a lady, especially a well-bred lady from the East, can ride in a horse race. Ken, you know how dangerous it is. You were nearly killed last year.
I wasn't nearly killed. I broke my arm.
In two places? And it could just as easily have been your neck.
I need a rider for the race on Monday, and she wants to ride. If she can do it, I say good for her.
Marshal Cairns stepped into the Boar's Head Saloon.
Yes, sir, Marshal Cairns. What can I do for you?
I heard tell there was a man in here who did some fancy shooting a half hour or so ago.
Yes, sir. Damnedest thing I ever seen.
Where is he now?
Wally nodded toward the shooter, who was still sitting alone at the table he had chosen on the far side of the room. Cairns looked in the direction Wally pointed.
Well, I'll be damned. What the hell is he doing here?
Do you know him, Marshal?
Yeah, I know him. Give me a bottle of whiskey and two glasses. What?
Mostly, you just get a beer.
What?
I mean, well, I don't ever charge you anything for the beer, being as you're the city marshal and all, but a bottle of whiskey, that's a little more expensive.
If you have a complaint, take it to the city council.
No, I don't have no complaints.
Wally pulled a bottle of whiskey from beneath the bar. He took two glasses down from the shelf and handed them to the marshal as well.
I was just commenting, is all.
Well, keep your commenting to yourself.
Yes, sir.
Taking the bottle of whiskey and glasses from the bar, Cairns walked over to join Mueller.
Hello, Luke. Long time no see.
Who the hell ever made you a deputy?
Oh, I ain't a deputy. I'm the city marshal. What the hell happened to your ear?
Dog bit it off.
What? How you let a dog bite your ear off?
What happened to my ear don't make no never mind. Are you serious? Are you really the marshal?
Yeah, I'm really the marshal.
Well, I'll be damned. Is this the same Egan Drum I know? Is this the same Egan Drum that held up a train in Missouri, killed a shotgun guard and a passenger during a stagecoach robbery in Kansas, and rustled cattle down in Texas? Is this the same Egan Drum that was riding with me and my brother when we stole that hog money from Doomy, and then wound up killing him and his whole family? Yeah, seeing as I was there, I would say that this is the same Egan Drum I know. So my question to you is, how the hell did Egan Drum become a city marshal?
Well, that's just it, Luke. My name ain't Egan Drum. Leastwise, not no more it ain't. It's Jimmy Cairns.
Jimmy Cairns? Wait a minute, wasn't that Wyatt Earp's deputy back in Wichita?
Yeah, it was. When I got here, come in just real handy to borrow his name. There was one or two here that had heard of him, but nobody that had ever actually seen him. So it was real easy to make the city council think I'd been a lawman in the past. They needed a city marshal, and that got me this job.
God damn. Well, wouldn't they be surprised if they knowed who you really was, and that you was wanted for robbery and murder in three states?
They'd think that Jimmy Cairns, killed Drum. And in a way, you might say that I did, seeing as how I don't use that name no more. I got a sweet deal here, Mueller. I wouldn't want anything to happen that would mess it up.
So, you expect to buy me off with a couple of glasses of whiskey, is that it?
Not exactly. Truth is, I reckon we can sort of scratch each other's back, so to speak.
How?
Well, to begin with, I have a paper in my office that says you're a wanted man. Seems you and your brother held up a bank in McAllister, Colorado, and you killed a couple people doing it. Sorry to hear about what happened to your brother, by the way.
You got paper on me?
Oh, yeah. Fresh paper with a new reward. You're worth $1,500, Luke. You know that.
What are you getting at?
Just this. You're going to need a safe place to hang your hat. A place where you don't have to keep looking behind you. You can stay here. There ain't nobody going to bother you.
You said you had paper in your office. What if somebody recognizes me?
I got two deputies. One will recognize you, and one won't.
What? Which one will recognize me?
Bert Appleby.
He's here? He's a deputy?
Yeah. I had to take him on as deputy. I didn't have no choice. He seen who I was right off the bat.
Maybe he won't recognize me. I ain't seen him since we pulled that job together back in Missouri. It's been 5 years ago at least. And as I recall, we wasn't exactly good friends then.
There ain't no way he won't recognize you. You ain't exactly an easy man to forget.
Like I told you, we didn't get along all that good. What if he decides to tell folks who I am?
Appleby is wanted for murder back in Missouri his own self. He ain't likely to want to open that can of worms.
I reckon not. What if somebody else recognizes me?
As far as I know, there ain't nobody else in town that would actually know you other than Appleby. But if anybody thinks they recognize you from your description or something, I'll just tell them that they're wrong. I'll tell them that I met the real Luke Mueller. While you might look something like him, you ain't him. I'll tell folks you're my first cousin.
Huh. And what do you want for that?
Like I said, we'll be scratching each other's back. I won't tell anyone who you are, and I don't want you to tell anyone who I am. In addition, from time to time, I might also require some, let's say, special services done. The kind of services that a man in my position, being as I'm the marshal and all, can't do. Something that someone like you can perform for me.
There any money to be made from these services?
What you need money for. From what I heard, you got a pretty good haul at that bank holdup. Am I hearing wrong?
No. But you may have heard that an hombre by the name of McAllister got on our trail. He's the one that killed Cleet and the others. That caused me to have to leave town pretty fast, and I left the money behind.
I read that McAllister recovered most of the money. I figured that meant you managed to keep some of it.
Not a damn cent. The only money that wasn't recovered was what we had already spent. I'll tell you this, though, we was having us a fine time with the money we was spending.
Until McAllister butted in, right?
Yeah, until McAllister butted in. That's why I put out $1,000 reward to anyone who'd kill the son of a bitch.
You got $1,000 reward out for McAllister?
Yeah. Ain't that rich putting out paper on him?
I thought you didn't have any money.
I don't have the money. And reward ain't nothing but a bluff.
What would you do if someone did kill him and tried to collect?
I just want the son of a bitch dead. I'd have to cross that bridge when I come to it.
Then you damn sure do need to stay here for a while. So, we have a deal, Luke?
Yeah, Drum, we have a deal.
It ain't Drum. Get used to calling me Cairns. Come on down to the jail with me.
What do you mean, come on down to the jail with you? What you got in mind?
I ain't got nothing in mind. Just gonna introduce you to my deputies now, that's all.
Well, you better not be pulling a fast one on me.
You don't have to worry about that. I told you. I got as much to lose as you do.
Yeah, I reckon you do that, don't you?
When Janelle arrived at the livery stable, she had changed clothes. She was wearing a riding skirt, which was split into panels that would allow her to button off the panels to either side. thus creating riding breeches. Ken had saddled Vexation by the time Janelle arrived.
You sure you want to do this?
I'm sure.
What's going on in here?
Janelle, this is Murray Housewright, owner of this stable. Murray, I'm going to let Miss Wellington ride Vexation around in your corral, if you don't mind.
She's going to ride Vexation in them clothes?
I imagine she is. She's about to ride him, and that's what she's wearing.
I ain't never seen nothing like that.
It's called a riding habit. It allows me to ride astride.
Women can't ride astride. Their thighs is too rounded. They can't stay in the saddle.
So I've heard. But I'd sure like to give it a try.
All right. Go ahead. I think this is something I'd like to see.
Janelle took the reins from Ken and mounted the horse. She slapped her heels against its side, and Vexation bolted forward as if shot from a cannon. Seeing a watering trough that protruded out from a windmill, she headed directly for it, intuitively feeling the horse under her gathering itself for the jump.
Look out, miss! You're about to... Good God!
That horse sprang from the ground with its legs extended fore and hind. It sailed over the watering trough as if it had wings, and then it landed gracefully on the other side, continuing at full gallop. Janelle gave the horse its head, allowing it to race all the way around the paddock, staying close to the fence. Finally, she guided Vexation back to where Ken Buckner and Murray Housewright were standing, eyes wide open in shock over what they had just seen.
He's a good horse.
Janelle handed the reins back to Ken.
You really want to ride in the race Monday?
Yes, sir.
Well, I have to say, that's some of the best riding I've ever seen. So if you want the job, it's yours.
Thanks.
Janelle changed clothes again and returned to the Emporium.
Well, I must say, my dear, you made quite an impression on Ken here. He's now saying he actually thinks you might win the 4th of July race on Monday.
I'll be riding to win, I know that.
Oh, by the way, Janelle, I stopped by the post office before coming back to the shop. You have a letter.
Thank you. I'll read it later.
Janelle took the letter and slipped it under the counter.
Mrs. Buckner, if you will give me Mrs. Guthrie's dress, I will go into the back and work on it now.
The Buckners watched Janelle gather up the brightly colored material and the dress and head into the back, where sat the most valuable commodity of the store, the sewing machine.
She won't, you know.
Hmm? She won't what?
She won't read the letter.
Well, how do you know?
Because she has already received 4 letters since she started working here, and all 4 are right there, under the counter, unopened and unread.
Hush, Rhoda, I'm figuring.
It had been almost 3 weeks since Rhoda turned up the little pile of gold nuggets. And in that time, Ben Hanlon had dug under every mesquite tree, every saguaro and choya cactus, and every rock. He had dug into indentations at the base of the mountain and scrambled halfway up the side of the mountain looking for a washout area that could have dumped the nuggets down to the ground below. All without success. It was mid-afternoon now. He sat with his back against a large rock and examined what he had found on that first day. 46 pecan-sized nuggets, each nugget being 1/2 to 3/4 gold. He hefted them in his hand.
Rhoda, I figure these things weigh about 4 pounds total. Now, if half that weight's gold, we got ourselves 32 ounces of gold. How'd it come up with that? Well, I figured the gold's heavier than the rocks themselves, so if we got 4 pounds, more than half of it's gold. But we gotta be cautious in our figuring, see? So I'm figuring it at just half. And at $20 an ounce, that there is, now give me a goddamn minute. Figures to, $640. Hoo-wee! Rhoda, That's more money than we've brung in the last 5 years. Oh, that's fantastic. Hey, googly mooglers.
At that moment, the shadow of Weaver's Needle had passed by the face of Superstition Mountain, exposing an opening about 500 feet up the side of the mountain. The opening was shaped like a grinning mouth, not very wide from side to side and not very high. In fact, Ben conjectured one could only enter that opening by crawling through.
Rhoda, how in the world did we not see that before? We've been on and around Superstition Mountain for more years than I can remember, and we camped right in this very spot more times than I can count. But I never see... No!
Even as Ben was staring at the spot, it disappeared.
It's gone. How could that be? Unless it ain't really there at all, Rhoda. Did I really see it? Am I going loco? Yeah, well, sure, you'd say that, but... Well, hell, I have heard of men going crazy here on Superstition. Maybe they went crazy seeing things that wasn't there. Maybe there ain't no opening. Maybe it was just a mirage.
Ben Hanlon could not leave it alone. He climbed up the side of the mountain the next day, taking the better part of 2 hours. As he was climbing, he kept looking, and he did not see one damn thing. And then... he was right on it. He wriggled inside. And back just a little way from the opening, he saw the gold flashing in the sunlight. When Hanlon climbed back down that mountain more than an hour later, his stomach was rolling and his head was spinning. But he was very careful. What a foolish thing it would be to fall now after having made his discovery. When he got back down to the foot of the mountain, he looked up and he saw nothing, even though he knew exactly where to look. Then suddenly, the opening appeared to him, as clear as day, though it was visible for less than a minute before it disappeared again.
I'll be damned, Rhoda! I got it all figured out now!
Hanlon pointed up.
Well, you see, Rhoda, it's like this. Because of the angle of the opening and because of the shadow cast on the opening by Weaver's Needle, the mouth of that there cave is only visible for a few minutes each day.
Now, Ben had no calendar, but looking at the position of the sun, he knew it was probably late June or early July.
Fact of the matter is, I'll just bet that as the sun changes position during the seasons, the actual opening's only visible for a few minutes each day, and, Rhoda, only for a few days in early summer. Yeah, hell, within another couple of weeks you won't be able to see it again, not till next year. No wonder it's done been lost for so many years.
Hanlon drew out a quick claim on a piece of paper, put it in an empty peach can, then buried the peach can under a pyramid of rocks. On the claim, he was purposely vague about the location of the mine, and that way, he was able to establish his claim without giving away so much specific information that anyone who might see the quick claim would actually be able to find the gold. On a second piece of paper, Ben Hanlon drew out an extremely accurate map. He wanted to make certain he could find the cave later, especially since he knew now how hard it was to find. Finally, he stashed all his mining equipment.
All righty, Rhoda. We got enough nuggets in this here leather pouch to tide us over till we get back. What say we skedaddle to Phoenix?
The sun had scarcely risen on the morning of the 4th of July when the residents of McAllister Valley started coming into town. By horseback, in surreys, buckboards, and wagons they came. From individuals to whole families, from babes in arms to the very old. Most brought picnic lunches, because this was going to be a day-long celebration. The front of all the buildings, as well as the lantern poles, were decked out in red, white, and blue bunting. Cape McAllister Boulevard, McAllister's Main Street, ran east and west. Two huge banners were spread across the boulevard now, one at each end of the street. The one that greeted visitors who were arriving from the west read, "Our nation celebrates its birthday." And at the east end of Cape McAllister Boulevard, or the Katy, as the locals called it, was another banner that stated, "We honor our founder, Jamie Ian McAllister." The Katy had been closed off to horse and vehicle traffic, so those who were coming into town from out in the valley were directed to park their conveyances in a huge open area behind Schultz Mercantile Store. Leaving their wagons, buckboards, and surreys behind them, they poured into town, joining with the growing throngs. Already, people were setting off firecrackers, and the town's children, who were running through the street, in and around people, vending booths and kiosks, were joined by children just arriving from the valley. The Katy was awash with the aromas of grilled sausages, freshly made fudge, bacon pastries, and popped corn. Lemonade, sarsaparilla, and beer were being sold at the street booths, though a city ordinance had declared that whiskey could only be sold in the saloons. Like every other town in the West, McAllister made a special holiday out of the 4th of July. But this year, the excitement was even greater, because they would also be dedicating a statue to the memory of their founder and namesake, Jamie Ian McAllister, the patriarch of the McAllister clan. The bronze statue was mounted on its pedestal in a specially constructed median in the middle of Cape McAllister Boulevard. A stage had been erected just to one side of the statue, which was under a shroud now, pending its official unveiling. The guest of honor for the day was the Honorable James Benton Grant, governor of the state of Colorado. As it was Independence Day, several cities and towns in the state had requested the governor's presence, nearly all of them larger than McAllister. It spoke volumes of the governor's respect for Jamie Ian McAllister and the whole McAllister clan that he chose to go there. Governor Grant had arrived by train from Denver the day before and spent the night in the Morning Star Hotel, which was the finest hotel between Denver and San Francisco. The governor's special train, consisting only of an engine, a tender, and a private car, sat on a sidetrack at the depot. The engine was dark green with brass fittings and gold-painted striping. The spokes of the wheels were red, and it became an object of attention as many of the valley people walked down just to have a special look at the beautiful train. The name painted in gold script on the side of the engine was the Columbine. The Columbine was a flower that many wanted to become the official state flower of Colorado. Across town in the Morning Star Hotel, a special reception was being held in the hotel ballroom. The reception room was absolutely packed with men, women, and children. And except for the governor, his personal staff, and the employees of the hotel itself, every single person present was a member of the McAllister family. The children of Jamie and Kate, all the way down to their great-grandchildren. Governor Grant stood near the buffet table, holding a cup of coffee.
It is a wonderful day, Mr. McAllister.
Yes, it is, Governor. I just wish Reverend Powell could be here. I know that he was really looking forward to giving the invocation.
You think your father is here with us today?
Falcon thought for a moment, then he realized what the governor was asking.
Yeah. No doubt in my mind, Brother Paul's here.
And so is Reverend Powell. No doubt they're sitting together over in some corner, catching up on stories of old times.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Ladies and gentlemen! Would you all please come outside? The festivities are about to begin.
Falcon, the governor, and the others were led outside, then up onto the stage. Looking out over the street, Falcon was amazed at how many people were there. Though the population of McAllister was only a little over 3,000, he estimated there were at least 5,000 or more people in this crowd. Joe Cravens, McAllister's newly elected mayor, stepped to the front of the stage and held up his hands for silence.
Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce the good Reverend Pyron.
Pyron was not yet out of his 20s, but all those who attended his church admitted that the young parson was definitely what they called a go-getter.
Good morning, folks. Before I begin the invocation, I would like to take a moment to remember the man who was supposed to do this. He was my friend and mentor and a personal friend of the man we are all here to honor today. If you would please, keep the Reverend Charles Powell and his wife Claudia in your thoughts as we bow our heads, please.
Quietly, respectfully, the audience bowed their heads.
Lord, we offer thanks for the life of Jamie Ian McAllister. We pray for your blessings on his family and on the valley and on this town which bears his name. We pray that all who might view this statue in the years to come will be inspired by the life of the man this statue represents. Amen.
Mayor Cravens once more stepped to the front of the stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, I now have the distinct honor and personal privilege of introducing to you our governor, the Honorable, the esteemed James Benton Grant.
Jamie Ian McAllister was but a boy living in Ohio when a Shawnee war party killed his parents. The same Shawnee who killed his parents adopted him into their tribe, where Jamie learned the warrior's way. Although he learned much from the Shawnee, he escaped from them and, at the tender age of 12, began his life on his own. Soon after, he met Kate Olmsted. He and Kate married in the small river town of New Madrid, Missouri, then came west. Jamie fought with the defenders of the Alamo, leaving with a packet of farewell letters the night before the Alamo fell. When the war of northern aggression struck our country, the McAllister family became a microcosm of this nation. For just as our country was divided, so was the McAllister family. Following their hearts, some fought for the North and some for the South. But at the end of the war, they were fully reunited, just as was our great nation. We are here today for a special dedication. It is our intention for this beautiful work of art to project into the ages yet to come the dream, the aura, and the spirit of Jamie Ian McAllister.
At that, the cover was drawn away, revealing a bronze statue of a man who had broad shoulders, narrow hips, and massive arms. The statue of Colonel Jamie Ian McAllister depicted him holding a pistol in each of his large hands. Afterwards, the guests on the stage mingled with the crowd. Many wanted to interact with the children of the great Jamie McAllister, and for nearly an hour, McCady was teeming with people. Finally, Falcon managed to extricate himself from the well-wishers. He went to get Lightning and start his ride home. Suddenly, Gary Baxter poked his head out of the door of the Western Union office.
Hey, Falcon! Wait a moment, would you? I have a telegram for you.
Baxter waved a piece of paper. Weary of the morning's seemingly endless activities, Falcon wanted nothing more than to just ride home. But he angled his horse toward the telegrapher.
It came about an hour ago, but there were too many in the crowd for me to find you.
Well, thanks.
As you'll see when you read it, that's from your brother and sister in New York. Oh, that sister of yours is sure one pretty woman.
Oh, thank you. I'm sure she'd be flattered. I imagine this is some comment about the unveiling of Paul's statue.
Nope, sure isn't. Yes, sir. Rosanna is a pretty woman with a pretty name. She never got married, has she?
Married to a Frenchman for a while, but he was sort of puny fella. He got sick and died.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Well, he wasn't all that popular with the rest of the family.
Oh, wow. Sorry for her then. Not you all. And she's never remarried?
No. So there's still hope for you, Gary.
Oh! Shucks. I didn't mean me. Not with someone like your sister, that is. Although I must say, it does make one wonder what's wrong with the men in New York, letting such a pretty woman stay single this long.
Well, who knows? Could be my sister would prefer a good Western man to those effete fellows she sees in New York. But, Gary, I should probably read this telegram now.
Oh, I can recite it for you if you like.
Okay.
As you know, Rosanna and I open new play on July 11th. Stop. Play said to be most important in New York this season. Stop. Would greatly appreciate some family support from our favorite brother. Stop. Andrew. So, are you going?
Huh?
To New York to see the new play, I mean. Are you going?
You know, Gary, I didn't think you were supposed to read other people's telegrams.
Well, I'm not supposed to, but heck, you tell me this. If I'm the one that gets the message and writes it down, how can I not read it?
I guess you're right. There's no way you can write out the telegram without reading it.
So, you aren't sore with me?
Oh, no, of course not.
Oh, good. So, are you going?
I don't know, Gary. I guess I'll have to think about it for a bit.
Oh, better not think too long. I checked, and it'll take you 5 days to get there. And I figure you want to be a dare so early, which means you're just about going to have to leave, today.
Of all the McAllister siblings, Falcon was the only one to have actually gone to New York to visit Andrew and Rosanna. And he had done that on several occasions. In addition, he had hosted them in their rare visits back home. Falcon considered the invitation. Should he accept it? Now that the dedication of his father's statue had taken place, there was no reason not to go. He did love his brother and sister, and he admired and respected their talent.
Oh, if it were me, I'd be going. Tell him about the dedication of the statue to Colonel McAllister. Mr. Dysart was taking photographs of it. Andrew and Rosanna will likely want to see what it looks like.
Thanks, Gary. That's a good idea. Maybe I will go.
Oh, good. Say, listen. Tell your sister that if she ever gets back to McAllister and wants someone to take her around to show all the sights and have a good time, why, I'd be more than glad to do it.
I'll tell her.
Really? You'll tell her?
Sure.
Nah, don't tell her. She'd just wonder what sort of goofy fool would say such a thing.
I think she would find the offer flattering, Gary, and I'd be glad to tell her.
Nah, don't tell her.
I'll tell her.
Don't tell her.
I'm telling her.
Well, thanks, Falcon.
Don't mention it.
Hey, what do you mean a woman's going to be riding in the race? There ain't no way that's going to happen.
Mayor of Phoenix, John Alsop, who was in charge of all the festivities of the town for the 4th of July celebration, was beginning to tire this routine. Ellis was the third rider to protest Janelle's inclusion in the big race.
And why isn't that going to happen?
What do you mean, why? Because it just ain't right, that's all.
There's no rule or law against it. As the mayor of this town and the chairman of the 4th of July celebration, I am saying that Miss Wellington can ride in this race.
Murray Housewright couldn't resist getting in a dig.
What's the matter, Ellis? Are you afraid you'll be beaten by a woman?
Nah, it ain't that. It's just that, well, riding in a race can be dangerous. You seen what happened last year when Collins and Mr. Buckner ran into each other? Mr. Buckner broke his arm, and Collins had to destroy his horse.
That don't mean it's going to happen this year.
Yeah, but it might, if you get someone that don't know how to ride.
Believe me, Ellis, the young lady can ride.
Oh, how do you know, Housewright?
Because I seen her ride, that's how I know. Look, you can complain all you want about whether or not a woman should ride, but don't be saying it's because she don't know how to.
What's it going to be, Ellis? Are you going to ride or not?
Am I going to ride? That ain't the question.
Yes, it is the question. Because I tell you now, Miss Wellington is going to participate in this race. So if you don't like it, you have two choices. Either accept it and ride, or don't accept it and don't ride. So which will it be? Are you going to ride or not?
Yeah, I'm going to ride. There ain't no way I'm not going to ride. But I tell you plain and I tell you true. It ain't right for a woman to be in the race.
Then I suggest you get ready, because I'm going to start this race in about an hour.
Janelle rode up to the starting line. The race would be down central, starting at McDowell Road. The riders would go to the Indian School Road, then turn around and come back. The first rider to cross McDowell on the way back would win. Janelle looked down the road and saw hundreds, maybe as many as 1,000 or more people crowded on both sides of the street. Most, she knew, would be against her because she was a woman, and like Ellis, they did not believe that a woman should ride. But she did have a small galley of supporters, too. Mr. and Mrs. Buckner, Mrs. Poindexter, and the other residents of the boarding house. She saw them waving at her and gave them a small wave in return. Mayor Alsop climbed up onto a small stand at the edge of the street, even with the starting line. He had his gun with him.
Gentlemen and lady, get ready!
Alsop pulled the trigger. The horses leapt forward. Although most of the horses were cowboy favorites, fastest from the various ranches, only Vexation had actually been trained as a racehorse. Shooting away like a cannonball, he got the best start. Janelle had pulled the stirrups up real high to keep her feet up, her knees bent close in. She leaned forward from her waist with her head and shoulders only inches above Vexation's neck. He was all strength and sinew, and as he galloped down the road, she felt almost as if she were one with his musculature. The crowd on either side of the road flashed by with such speed they were a blur. But she wouldn't have been able to identify anyone's face even if she had known them, because she was going too fast to see. When she reached Indian School Road, she turned and started back. She was pleasantly surprised to see that she was at least 100 yards ahead of her nearest competitor, Ellis. Because he was so vocal in his protest over her riding, Janelle figured he probably had the most to lose. As he drew closer, she moved over slightly to give the cowboy room to pass, but he followed. First, she thought it was because he was trying to avoid her, but when she turned again, she saw that it wasn't an accident. He was purposely trying to run her down. Janelle was left with three choices: give way by riding off the road, in which case she would be disqualified, run into a vending stand, which was protruding into the road, or cross the road into the path of the other horses.
Yeah!
To everyone's surprise, she headed right for the vending stand, urging the horse up. Vexation leapt, cleared the stand by inches, and came down in full stride on the other side. When she looked back, she was surprised to see that Ellis was nowhere close. He had broken off the race after Janelle jumped the vendor's booth. The Buckners ran up to her.
You were magnificent. I've never seen anything like that.
Janelle wrapped her arms around the horse's neck.
Vexation is a very good horse. I've never ridden a better horse.
He is good, isn't he? I'm so proud of him, but I must say I'm just as proud of you. In fact, I'm so proud of you that I'm giving you the $100 prize money.
Oh, you don't have to do that, Mr. Buckner. It was your horse that won.
I know, and I'm going to keep the trophy. I think I shall keep it in the window of the Emporium so that everyone who sees it will be reminded that it was a woman who rode the winning horse in the 4th of July race.
The day after Independence Day, Janelle was busy spreading a display of colorful material. True to his promise, Ken Buckner had put that Silver Cup winner's trophy in the window, and it was Nellie's idea to combine that with business. She reasoned that if people were going to come and look at the trophy, she may as well let them see what kind of material she had for sale, too. Ken agreed, and the two of them left it up to Janelle to construct an artistic display rather than just lay out bolts of cloth. Janelle had risen to the task, and the window had become a veritable meadow of color, with cascading browns and carpeting greens, billowing yellows and floating blues, all designed to draw attention to the display. As she was working on the display, she saw a grizzled old man riding a mule down the street.
What is it? Why are you laughing?
Janelle pointed out the window.
Oh, that man. I've never seen anyone who looked like that before.
Oh, that's just a prospector.
A prospector?
Someone who's looking for gold. Or silver, or turquoise, or whatever they can find. They spend months, sometimes years, out in the desert.
Why on earth would anyone ever do such a thing? Do they actually think they will find something?
Well, sometimes they do. Not very often, but evidently often enough to keep the hope alive in poor souls like that one.
Poor soul?
Yes. Look at him, Janelle. You can tell by looking that he is barely able to keep body and soul together. Why, I'll bet he doesn't have 5 cents to his name.
Oh, how terrible. How does such a person live? I'm ashamed now that I laughed at him.
At that moment, the door opened and a tall, gray-haired, distinguished-looking man came in.
Good morning, Mr. Montgomery. May I help you?
I'm shopping for my wife's birthday. I'll look around a bit.
Go right ahead.
Nellie turned her attention back to the window.
Oh, Janelle, that is beautiful.
After wandering around a bit, Montgomery picked up one of the hats Nellie had recently received. He spent a long moment examining it as he held it in his hand.
Tell me, Mrs. Buckner, do you think my wife would like this? The reason I ask is I thought I might get her a bonnet, but I've never seen anything like this.
That is called a flower pot.
A flower pot? You plant flowers in it?
Janelle, please come over here and tell Mr. Montgomery about this hat, will you?
Of course.
You are the young lady who rode in the race yesterday, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Well, I must tell you, the entire town is proud of you.
Thank you.
And you work here?
She does. She has the most marvelous eye for fashion. And she also keeps our books.
This young lady keeps your books?
She does indeed. Now, you wanted to ask her opinion about that hat?
Yes, I do. Is it stylish? I mean, if we went to some big city like Denver, St. Louis, or New Orleans, would she be... Well, I'm not sure what the word is I'm looking for, but would she be out of place?
She would not be out of place at all. That hat is very stylish.
Janelle put the hat on her own head and tilted it just so. She smiled as she was modeling the hat, and the smile lit up her face.
Oh, my. That is beautiful.
I assure you, Mr. Montgomery, if your wife wore this hat, she would be fashionable not only in Denver, St. Louis, or New Orleans, but I have seen this same hat perched on the head of the most fashionable ladies of New York and Paris as well.
New York and Paris? You've been to those places?
I have.
And at the price of $2, you won't get a better bargain.
$2? Isn't that a bit high for such a small bit of straw?
Oh, a small bit of straw? Mr. Montgomery, calling this a small bit of straw is like calling Michelangelo's Statue of David a small piece of marble.
You make a good point, Miss... I didn't get your last name, and it would hardly do for me to call you by your Christian name.
It is Wellington. Janelle Wellington.
I see what you mean, Mrs. Buckner, when you tell me she has an eye for fashion. And you say she also does your books?
Yes, she does.
Tell me, Miss Wellington, are you an educated woman? And by that I mean, have you attended a school beyond the normal public school?
Oh, yes. My father believed in education, even for women. I matriculated from Cornell, one of the few private colleges that will admit women.
Cornell, yes, I've heard of it. It's a very good school. And good for your father. He is truly a man ahead of his time. I think the time will come when men and women are given equal opportunities for education.
Oh, what a foolish idea. Beyond the ability to read, I see absolutely no reason for a woman to have an education.
Unfortunately, there are a great number of people who feel just as you do. Therefore, it might be quite some time before my prediction comes true.
Do you wish to buy the hat, Mr. Montgomery?
You are a woman with a mind for business, Miss Wellington, and I appreciate that. Yes, I will buy the hat.
C.D. Montgomery was president of the Sun Valley Bank and Trust, and after having his purchase gift wrapped, he took it back to the bank with him and let himself into his office through a side door.
Yes?
Montgomery's secretary, Jarvis Depro, stuck his head inside.
Mr. Montgomery, there is someone waiting to see you. I told him I'm sure you wouldn't be interested in meeting with him, but he wouldn't go away. I'm afraid he's rather insistent.
Why do you think I wouldn't be interested in seeing him?
Because he is most unkempt, sir. He may be the filthiest man I've ever seen. He smells.
Jarvis, Have you been around some of our leading citizens? The fact that the person waiting to see me smells is not particularly significant. Please, show him in.
Very good, sir.
Leaving Montgomery's office, Depro just stood there looking at the strange, scruffy little man for a moment. Then he walked over to him.
Mr.
Hanlon! Ben Hanlon!
Mr. Hanlon, Mr. Montgomery will see you now.
Well, thank you, Sonny. I'll remember you in my will.
Mr. Montgomery, this is Mr. Ben Hanlon.
Thank you, Jarvis. Won't you have a seat, Mr. Hanlon?
Well, thank you kindly. Here now, you're going to want to take a look at this.
Thank you, sir.
Ben scratched his scraggly beard, feeling one of the lice move quickly to escape his clawing fingers. Leaning back in his chair, he examined the room. The calendar on the wall said it was Tuesday, July 5th, 1885.
It's 1885? Good God, I thought it was sometime in the 1870s, maybe 78, 79. That means I've been prowling around on Superstition Mountain for 10 years, maybe? Good God!
Montgomery looked up from the paper Ben had given him.
Mr. Hanlon, what you are asking is highly unusual.
How come? This here's a bank, ain't it? Don't banks lend money to folks?
Yes, we are here to lend money to people, but only to people with a good prospect of being able to pay it back. Oh, and of course, people with collateral.
Collateral? What's that mean?
It means that in order to get a loan, you have to put something up of value, generally of the same or more value than the amount of money you are asking for.
Well, hell, ain't that what I just done? Didn't I just give you that there piece of paper?
But I can't make heads or tails of this. What is it?
It's what you was asking for. It's collateral.
It's a piece of paper.
It's a map. It's a map to the richest gold mine what's ever been found. I aim to put that map up so as to borrow enough money to start working that mine. Now, I'm going to be needing me some food, and by that I mean some real store-bought food, not that desert rats and cactus fruit I've been eating, and maybe a couple more mules. Yeah, seeing as I'll be hauling out more ore than Rhoda's going to be able to carry by herself. Oh, I'm going to be wanting me some new duds, too. These here clothes is plumb worn out, and I'm going to be needing me some...
Hold it, slow down here.
What?
Mr. Hanlon, I'm surprised at you paying good money for a map like this. Do you have any idea how many maps there are to the Peralta mine? Where did you buy this?
I didn't buy it nowhere! I drawed that there map my own self. Tells you exactly where the gold is.
You're telling me you know where the gold is?
Yes, sir, that's exactly what I'm telling you. And I need me some money to buy me some new supplies. And like I said, maybe some more clothes, a couple of mules. I might even give me a bath. Oh, Lord, I reckon it's been some 20 years or so since I had me a proper bath. I mean, in a bathtub with soap and all.
Do you have any proof that you found the mine? I mean, other than this map.
Oh, yes, sir, I got me some proof.
Ben unbuttoned a couple of his shirt buttons, then reached his hand inside, pulling out a small rawhide sack. He dumped the contents on Montgomery's desk.
These here's nuggets I took from the mine. And there's a lot more where these came from.
Montgomery picked up one of the rocks, cleaned it off, and then began turning it in his hand. He stopped turning when he saw a streak of yellow metal.
This.
Opening a drawer to his desk, he pulled out a knife and began digging at the yellow metal.
This is gold. This is real gold.
Well, yes, sir, that's what I've been trying to tell you all along. To tell you the truth, Mr. Montgomery, I reckon you might say that I'm a rich man. Only I ain't quite figured out how a rich man's supposed to act, you know, all highfalutin' and such.
How much gold do you have, Mr. Hanlon?
Well, right now all I got's what's in this here bag. But like I said, there's a heap more where this come from. Now, I figure the rest of it would be safer where it is rather than me bringing a whole lot of it into town. That is, seeing there don't nobody but me know where the gold is at, yeah? Except now maybe you having the map and all.
Yes, I think you may be right. All right, Mr. Hanlon, I'll take that map as collateral, and I'll make you that loan.
Falcon McAllister spent 4 nights en route to New York City. On the morning of the 5th day, his train reached Grand Central Station. Emerging from the 4-story red brick building that was the Grand Central Depot, he stretched to work out the kinks in his body, wrought by spending the better part of a week on the train. The bright sunshine caused him to blink a few times as he looked around to take in the scene. Omnibuses, trolleys, and pedestrians made a kaleidoscope of movement and color on East 42nd Street.
Oh, Falcon! Over here!
Falcon saw his sister and brother standing beside a carriage. Smiling, he picked up his luggage and walked toward them.
Oh, it is so good to see you!
Rosanna gave Falcon a big welcoming hug, and Andrew shook his hand.
We appreciate you coming to see us.
Well, heck, I didn't come to see you. I came to see the new play you're in.
Whatever it takes to get you here, brother.
The driver of the carriage put Falcon's suitcase into the boot as the 3 McAllisters climbed in.
I have something to show you.
Falcon produced an envelope.
What is it?
Look inside.
Andrew opened the envelope, then pulled out a photograph.
Oh, my. My. Look at this, Rosanna.
For a long moment, Andrew and Rosanna stared at the photograph of the bronze statue of their father.
Oh, I wish we had been able to be there. What a wonderful tribute to father.
Falcon smiled. Everyone else in the family referred to him as Pa. Only Andrew and Rosanna had ever called him father.
I do hope everyone understood why we couldn't come.
Don't worry about it, Andrew. Everyone understands perfectly. No hard feelings.
That wasn't quite true, but Falcon saw no need to tell them otherwise. It was pretty obvious that they had very much wanted to come, and they would have come had they been able to. It took only 10 minutes to go from Grand Central Station to Shoemaker's Dining Salon on 6th Avenue, located next door to the Eagle Theater, where Andrew and Rosanna would star in the premiere performance of The Ideal Suitor.
Mademoiselle and Monsieur McAllister, what a delightful treat it is for us to serve you on the day before your opening.
Merci, Jacques. This is our illustrious brother, Falcon McAllister. I would advise you not to anger him. He is a man of no small repute in the Wild West.
Yes, I can see that. He is as powerful looking as he is handsome.
Falcon shifted uneasily.
Have Mr. and Mrs. Wellington arrived yet?
Ah, indeed they have. They are waiting for you in the private dining room.
Jacques snapped his fingers and a young man approached.
Jefferson!
Please show the McAllisters to the Golden Room, would you?
The Golden Room was a private dining room located on the top floor of the 3-story building. There was no mystery as to how it got its name, for the textured ceiling was overlaid with a thin layer of real gold. The walls were wainscoted, cherry wood below and textured wallpaper above, with a pattern of fleur-de-lis in green and gold. A rich green carpet covered the floor, while the table was covered in gold-colored cloth. Expensive gold-rimmed china, silverware, and crystal sparkled in the light from the gas lantern chandelier. A man and a woman rose to greet them as they entered. Both were late middle age, though they did look much younger.
Falcon, this is Joel and Emma Wellington. And this is my brother, Falcon.
Andrew and Rosanna, it is so good to see you. And a great privilege to meet your esteemed brother. Please, sit down. I have heard so much about you, Falcon. Your brother and sister are convinced you hung the moon.
My brother and sister tend to exaggerate.
Oh, I wouldn't know about that. They make their case brilliantly.
Falcon, Mr. Wellington is the angel for our new play. In fact, if truth be told, he is responsible for our very careers.
I would hardly say I was responsible for your careers. You two are the most talented couple in New York. All that was needed was the opportunity for you to show others what you could do. After that, you were both on your own.
Ah, but who provided us with that opportunity? It was you, and the many plays and performances you backed.
I consider it an investment. And with the way you two bring theatergoers to the plays, the investment has more than paid off. Andrew, have you mentioned it to him?
No, not yet.
Falcon noticed that all four of them were looking directly at him.
What is it?
I told Joel you would help him. I mean, considering how much he has done for Rosanna and me, I figure we owe him.
We owe him?
Well, by we, I meant that Rosanna and I owe him, but we have always stuck together as a family, have we not? And you, especially, have always gone out of your way to help others.
Mr. McAllister, you may be our only hope.
Well then, if I am your only hope, I'd better do all that I can, hadn't I?
I will pay any amount that...
Oh, stop right there. If I understand my brother and sister, you've already contributed more than enough in helping their careers. If it is something I am capable of doing, I'm more than willing to give it a try, and no pay is necessary.
Bless you, Mr. McAllister.
And thank you.
Well, it's about time I found out what I'm supposed to do, isn't it?
It's our daughter.
We want you to find her.
She's somewhere out west. That's why I suggested you would be the right person to look for her.
Somewhere out west? That covers a lot of territory.
We received a telegram from her, informing us that she was in Phoenix, in the Arizona Territory. Do you know that area?
Yeah, I've been there a few times.
Do you think you can find her?
Phoenix is not that large a place. If she's still there, she shouldn't be very hard to find.
Finding her is not the only task. You may have a problem in getting her to come home, and...
Mr. Wellington, I'll do what I can to talk her into coming home. But I hope you don't expect me to force her to come back, because I won't do that.
No. Nor would I expect you to.
Perhaps if you tell her she has nothing to be ashamed of, that her mother and father love her and that we want her, she'll come back.
Why would she think she should be ashamed?
The thing is, Mr. McAllister, Janelle had a child out of wedlock. She thought she loved the father, and she thought he loved her. The scoundrel's name is Boyd Zucker. He was a business partner of mine, younger than I, but substantially older than our daughter. And I don't think he ever had the slightest idea of marrying her. When the rogue learned of Janelle's, confinement, he claimed to have no part in it, and he refused to marry her.
Shortly after her baby was born, she gave him to her sister. Then she went west, claiming she could not face the shame.
We could have done more to stop her. It is true she left without our knowledge, but I think if we had been more understanding, we could have prevented her from leaving. But the truth is, I think we were feeling a little shame as well.
Please, Mr. McAllister, say that you will find her. I can't imagine how she must feel, abandoned first by the evil Mr. Zucker, and then by her own parents.
I'll find her.
Oh, I do hope you can.
Mrs. Wellington, if my brother says he can find Janelle, you can count on it. Falcon never goes back on his word.
Oh, thank you, Mr. McAllister. I don't know how to thank you enough.
Falcon knew he had just declared an absolute, and that was something he rarely did. But he knew also that he could not let these people down, and he derived a great deal of satisfaction from seeing their reaction to his promise. It was one of contentment, and he made a promise to himself to see to it that their confidence in him was not misplaced.
You will be going to the grand opening of the play tomorrow night, won't you?
Well, that's why I came to New York. I mean, that's why I thought I came to New York.
It is why you came. I want you to have a wonderful time while you're here. Please, allow me to pay for your hotel and dining expenses. It's the least I can do to repay you for what you're doing for Emma and I.
Oh, well, if I had known you were going to pay for the hotel, I would have gotten the finest suite available.